Hi, and welcome to the Design Systems Podcast. This podcast is about the place where design and development overlap. We talk with experts to get their point of view about trends in design, code, and how it relates to the world around us. As always, this podcast is brought to you by Knapsack. Check us out at knapsack.cloud. If you want to get in touch with the show, ask some questions, or generally tell us what you think, go ahead and tweet us at the DS Pod. We'd love to hear from you. Hey everyone, I'm here with Matt Strom. He leads design at Simple Health. He's a member of the W3C Design Tokens Community Group, and he also is a co-organizer of the New York Design Systems Coalition Meetup. Hey Matt, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk a lot about design APIs today, and this is kind of a latent concept that we've been toying with at Knapsack also, and I really love what you posted on Medium about it and kind of the conversations we've had so far. I think a really good starter, because this is a topic we haven't really covered a lot before, is just kind of kick off, like, what are design APIs and how do those relate to design systems?
Yeah, a design API is a concept that I sort of stumbled on after working with a lot of engineers on design systems. It comes from the same concept that engineers use, which is an API stands for Application Programming Interface. And that's just a fancy way of saying it's an automated way for two programs to talk to each other. So a design API is just a way for any two programs to talk to each other about design.
Gotcha. So you could say like Figma talking to, say, VS Code or something like that.
Exactly. Or Figma talking directly to your production application or iOS application, or Slack talking to GitHub. These are all possible when you have ways of standardizing the conversation that the machines are having about design.
Gotcha. So how do you take the steps to standardize that conversation? When you talk about, you know, things doing a lot of talking back and forth, usually there's some sort of boundary or control or some shared language that they use.
Yeah. So this was the way that I started thinking about APIs, was really based on the work that's being done around design tokens. And design tokens are an idea that is not terribly exciting when you just hear about it for the first time. I get a lot of people who say, oh wait, a design token, that's just like a text file, right? And it is pretty boring when you think about it that way. But people say the same thing about like HTML. Oh, that's just a text file, right? Well, the magic really happens when you realize that if you standardize that text file, then multiple different programs can expect the text to be formatted in a specific way. And so if you standardize the way a design token is formatted, then Figma can send information about design to Slack or to GitHub, and even then beyond them to your production application.
So like when you think about that concept of tokens and enabling that standard single file, what are you talking about actually enabling by that?
So when you have a single specification for how two programs talk about design, then you can achieve something called interoperability, where even though Figma has a completely different internal code structure and way of working with design, and my production application, like my iOS app, has a different way of talking about its internal code, they can kind of trade information about design in this single standardized format. And they don't really have to care about the way each application works. This is the basis of how APIs work and why APIs are so powerful as an abstraction.
Yeah, and this is actually like very akin to what we do in Knapsack, where we think about, you know, any single component or pattern inside of our system has a data schema that is attached to it. And that data schema represents that standardization of the format for how that data translates between applications.
Yeah, the way that I like to think about this and the way that APIs really work and allow programs to evolve is I get to take other programs. So let's say Bitly. Bitly is a way of shortening a link. If my program, let's say I have an application for sharing screenshots, if I really want to use that functionality of Bitly, I don't need to rebuild Bitly inside my own application. I can just send it an API request, and it's going to send back a short link. And so the design system is a similar kind of tool in our universe as designers and engineers. And the question is, wouldn't it be great if instead of recreating the design system in Figma, recreating the design system in code, recreating the design system on my documentation site, I could just send an API call and receive the component or receive the color or receive the design decision that was made?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the enablement of this is interesting, right? Because we oftentimes have a hard time describing how APIs function when people live in a world of predominantly static assets, right? You have your static Gatsby site that is like your documentation site. You have your assets from Storybook that get created as a part of a build process. You have a bunch of say, you know, Adobe XD files that exist in design. All these represent these static assets that have difficulty connecting with one another. What you're thinking about is a world where all of those apps share information freely in real time between one another.
That's right. And they share it in a format that is an intermediary format. And so that they don't have to all standardize around the same CSS and JS library or the same C+ file format for saving a color palette. By coming up with this middle ground in an API, you allow everybody to work in their own individual way, but they still get to work together.
So how do you control change in an environment like that? Because it is really powerful, but also really scary to say like, hey, blue is now green inside of a design application and have that filter all the way down to my iOS app.
Yeah. The nice thing about using APIs as an abstraction for design systems is that really smart engineers have already figured out how to solve some of these problems. And with an API, because you're asking for a specific color, you can also send along what version of that color that you want. Or if you want something like, just give me the latest major version, or give me version 1.0. And this is something that a lot of engineers are very familiar with already if they use NPM, is you can use a static asset that is pulled down from a dynamic and constantly changing source of truth.
That's awesome. Yeah. And so, you know, when you think about the ability to have all these then network together applications where you have your design files, your code IDE, your documentation website, your downstream, you know, packages that you're handing over to your apps, you know, you like to call this concept network design systems. Tell me a little bit more about like that future and that vision of what that enables.
So I like to joke around with my colleagues and stakeholders that I'm constantly trying to put myself out of a job. And when I'm daydreaming on the weekends or thinking about the future of design, what I usually think about is what are the tasks that I do the most often every day and how do I automate them? How do I stop doing them? As a designer, one of the most common tasks that I do is just copying and pasting hex codes or pixel values from one text field into another, whether that's building a documentation site by, you know, typing the right specifications into Notion or sharing that with an engineer. And I was thinking, why do we need humans in the middle of all these conversations when the humans are really just like taking those values out of one database and then putting them into another database or code base somewhere else? So a network design system is just taking humans out of the equation as a middleman, where we're really just telling one system what the design decision is that was made in another system.
No, absolutely. And I think that one of the other things that really pushes back against is this idea of things becoming out of date. There's a staleness that happens when you have handoff. And that handoff process innately creates a fragmentation. And one of those fragments goes on to continue to evolve and be the canonical way of doing something. And the other immediately starts to become stale as a part of that process. And so if those are interlinked and one and the same and available in real time, it pushes back very much against that fragmentation and that staleness that is created inside of your docs.
That's right. I think that there's so much tension that's created in the design, engineering, product, decision-making world by the fact that the public-facing production application falls out of sync with our understanding so quickly. And all of the handoff files, all of the tools that we're using to communicate, it's all trying to get the production application or the thing that the user sees as close to our current understanding as possible.
So when I think about that, what we're talking about really is the ownership of fidelity, right? And that tension is around fidelity. And so who owns the fidelity at any one given point of time? And how is that fidelity reflected in the hands of a user? And that becomes a tennis match really quickly, right? Because I have this really elegant thing that is in design, and now that gets translated to code, and then what ends up in production is oftentimes somewhat different than what is designed in code. And for very good reason, right? Because, you know, innately tools like Figma have constraints that aren't applicable to things like app environments. And innately some code environments have to deal with differences in implementation from design tools. And so that tennis match over fidelity becomes a major focal point of a lot of those product building processes and conversations.
Yeah, the truth is that no designer's files look exactly like the version that the user sees on their screen. This mm-hmm. doesn't happen. And I think for a long time, we pretended like it does. Like a designer designs something on their screen, and then an engineer takes that and they make it look like that on the user's screen. But there's always some negotiation. There's always some compromise. There's always constraints that we discover along the way. And I think that when you have this design file that as soon as it's done is an inaccurate representation of the world, like that file ceases to become useless. So with something like a design API or tokens or design systems in code, what we're doing is we're just kind of removing the design file as the source of truth or the artifact, final artifact, you know, the cosmic creator. Really, what we're doing is we're all finally admitting that the pixels on the design file were just a guess.
Right, an illustration, if you will. I think that it is really interesting to think about that, right? Because that's maybe one of the better explanations of the difference between a static asset and a dynamic API that I've heard, right? Is the moment that you hand over that design file and that handoff happens, that static asset is still not the representation of truth in the system. And the ability to manage the change both to that file and to all of the downstream things that come after it is something that should happen in a real-time manner, not in this stop-start of static assets.
Exactly. I just got this weird sort of metaphorical image in my head of designers as sort of wizards or clerics. And what we're doing when we're creating these design files is like drawing these salt circles and runes and chanting spells. And what we're really trying to do is affect some change in the production app by having all of these rituals and things like this. So we're just trying to make it look different for the user. And so then that's where handoff tools come in. That's where like abstract and version control for design comes in. And I think we're really jumping through a lot of hoops to try and maintain the old ways. And really what we should be doing is exploring ways of just, let's get rid of all the tooling in between. So that's why I think an API that uses tokens to communicate in a standard interoperable way is a major step towards that future.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love the idea of like this druidic circle of designers all chanting to invoke like the gerbil gods or something like that. I mean, you got me with the D&D reference, admittedly. Like I have a deep amount of love for D&D. So, you know, I guess the new way of thinking would be artificers or something like that. But yeah, the idea of like the preservation of the traditional methods of design and development, I think that when we talk about the blending of roles between designers and developers, that's a big part of what we're talking about, is the breakdown in these traditional ideas of what a designer is. And I think that that evolution has been happening for decades, right? I mean, you know, you had a bunch of those early digital folks that were effectively print designers before they were ever digital designers. And now you have a bunch of people that grew up in the digital era that are now adjusting their own way of thinking and their own processes towards a much more system-centric approach.
That's right. We are still, as designers, trying to hold on to some of those graphic design metaphors. And I say trying. I don't know if anybody is deliberately like, this is the way things should be. But I think that there's a lot of backbend that we have to do to try and preserve this idea that I am indicating that a link should be blue and that everybody should see the same blue that I see, or that I am saying that this font size should be 16 pixels and that on everybody's screen it's 16 pixels, when in reality, that's never the case. Like, right. even if I have a design system that's very rigid about the font size, users can still zoom their screen in. It's not going to really ever be as standard as I think it is.
Yeah, those variables change based on implementation and based on runtime. And I think that's why you see like people playing with things like adaptive color and stuff like that, right? Is innately saying like, this is the blue, or this is the line height, or this is the number of rems in this particular bit of typography. Like, all of that, the consumption point for a user can change.
Yeah, what we're getting towards with things like the adaptive color palettes that Adobe is doing, with things like the type scaling system that Typetura is doing, is honoring the intention of the design and not being too picky about the actual implementation of it. What I mean by that is, as a designer, when I say that this text should be black on a white background, what I'm largely saying is that this text should be highly legible. Mm-hmm. So if I had a way of telling the end user's application, so if the end user is using a Kindle, or if they're using an iPhone, or if they're using a screen reader, how does that implementation interpret my intention of being highly legible? Like, wouldn't it be great if I could just let the client-side application make that decision for me in a way that is best for the user?
I really like that idea of honoring the intention but not being too committed to the implementation, if you will. I think that that's really what a lot of this is all about, is the idea that, you know, a lot of the end results of that design process are unknowable. And so what is the best way to express that intent? And I really love that as a concept of modern design is about intention and less about implementation.
Right. It's something that is hard because as designers, we're given the platform or put on this pedestal of being the very tasteful sort of person in the room and knowing the best colors or the best fonts. And a lot of our stakeholders look to us to be the expert about that. But really, what we're doing more and more in modern software product organizations is just trying to deliver some user experience and really ultimately delivering some business metric. And some of the window dressing about being very tasteful and having, you know, this really good sense of aesthetic tends to be kind of role-playing in a lot of cases.
And there's a lot of practical applications to this as well. So is when you think about the change in workflow, the change in structure of a design team in a more modern context, you know, what goes away? Like, if people are living that idea of expressive intention, what goes away? And I mean, certainly things are obvious, right? Like, we've all been in the position where it's like, hey, can you bump that logo 2 pixels left? And maybe that's not a great example, but that's definitely like one that has been very frustrated in the minds of developers. Or like, hey, we have a button that's 50 pixels high over here, a button that's 48 pixels high over here. Do those really need to be two different buttons? So those are the obvious things. But what are some of the unobvious things that change?
designers stop becoming librarians. And what I mean by that is we're no longer responsible for maintaining this very elaborate and, let's say, canonical reference for what things should look like. And at least for me, that's kind of liberating because I get really tired of being the person that my stakeholders go to whenever they need like a letterhead or an email signature or, you know, and if my stakeholders are listening to this, yeah, definitely Slack me. I'll totally get that for you. That's fine. But in the future, I really want to spend more of my time thinking about our user experience and trying to fix some of the serious problems with it. And thinking ahead to where when new technology comes out or new opportunities present themselves, how are we actually pursuing that? And, you know, I don't really want to spend as much time as I do today on renaming layers in Figma.
Absolutely. And so the idea from the design perspective is like, how do I focus on the more interesting work? Like, where does the real like creative well live? Does that live in the recreation of you know, a brand style guide or email signature or something like that? Or does that live in the realm of research around user interaction and really exploring new ways of thinking about how people experience the platform? And I mean, the obvious answer there is the latter seems a lot more interesting and is probably fundamentally more valuable to the organization. Even though a lot of those things like email signatures are necessary, you know, is that really moving the needle in terms of an objective for the organization? I would argue that a lot more like deep UX thinking, research, implementation of new ideas of experience are probably a lot more valuable.
That's right. I totally agree. I think that in the past, you say 20 years ago, UX research probably wasn't as important or wasn't as complex as it is today because the user numbers, the geography, the devices, the screen sizes, the assistive technology, it just wasn't creating the multitude of experiences that we have today. And so user research used to be like, get five people in a focus group, show them your app, and ask them what they think. Now it's, we have to understand how people are understanding and experiencing our application, because they can do so from their watch on the subway, mm-hmm. and they can do so on their phone while they're waiting in line at the pharmacy, and they can do so because they got an email from our newsletter that has a link to our promo code that gives them a discount on their next five orders. And so this kind of, say, explosion in the complexity of online digital experiences, that's made user experience the highest leverage work that a designer can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And this proliferation of these digital experiences kind of everywhere, like the customer surface area is 10 times the size it was a decade ago. And so controlling all of that surface area and being really thoughtful about it is a very significant challenge. I would say also one that is a lot more valuable than the, you know, 30th revision of a particular, you know, component inside of a library.
Absolutely. The complexity has increased 10 times, but the budget for the design team has not increased 10 times. The number of designers on the team hasn't increased 10 times. So each individual designer now has 10 times more responsibility. And that's why I think the sooner that we can hand off some of these more mundane and easily automated tasks to machines or algorithms, the more we can focus on the more complex stuff like user research, like innovation and understanding how people will be interacting with our experiences in 5 years' time.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I actually am really curious about how this impacts workflows directly. Like, we've all been in those places where we're conducting a design review that is all about comparing like a live website to a picture of a website. We've all been in that moment where, you know, a button state was missing and we had a 2-hour conversation about like what button states we should actually have inside of our application. You know, how do we move past those things? Because I view all those tasks as a part of the production aspect of design, not the UX and research aspect of design. And that's what we want to minimize. That's the mundane. That's the piece that isn't creative necessarily and is substantially less valuable than those more high-level activities. So how do we get rid of those as a part of this workflow?
Yeah, that's a dichotomy that I define as either design to deliver, which is the production aspect, and then the design to define, which is the more product spec and future thinking side. And the design to deliver, we can take things like a design system is one of the early examples of automation there. We can take a design API that uses tokens for interoperability, and we can start to turn that into what other roles call operations.
Yep.
So there's already so many cool examples from other types of disciplines. Yeah. So we can take inspiration from other disciplines, like developers have DevOps, sales has sales ops. And now design is starting to have design ops. And there's a lot of questions. What does design ops mean? Why do designers need ops? And I think that you've identified a very clear case for why designers need design ops is because we need to stop spending so much time on the production side of things and spend more time on the design to define side of things.
Yeah, that implementation versus intention piece again.
That's right.
Because I've always felt that the production aspect is a lot more about the implementation than creating that intention. And often to the point that intention is sort of defined once and then maybe a little lost along the way.
That's right. And I think that the more that we bring people into our discipline who are here to support us and help with that delivery piece, the more that we can really realize the potential of designers spending time on hard problems, like what does this application mean for the environment? Mm-hmm. What does this tool mean for social justice? And we can spend way less time on what color purple are we using.
Yeah, I love that. I love the idea of tackling some big, meaty, deep topics, because that's ultimately what creates those unique experiences. It's funny, before the show, we were talking about the music scene in Brooklyn and how that's evolved and changed as things have become less affordable for musicians, and it's sort of like removed these pockets of creativity, and how that now relates to restaurants, where, you know, you sort of had to follow a formula for a long time to be able to survive as a restaurant in Brooklyn or where I live in Portland. And now with, you know, the COVID crisis, which is obviously a horrible thing, you're going to, I think, see this interesting thing happen as we come out of it, where there's going to be these pockets of creativity that spring up because people are going to start to talk about the intention behind the food instead of the formula for a successful restaurant. And I think that that's an interesting sort of parallel to the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we tend to get too bogged down in creativity as it comes to aesthetics. And there's a lot of cool stuff you can do when you start to expand the scope of what is the medium and what is the format that you as a designer are really working in.
Well, speaking of that, you know, you mentioned earlier that you're writing a book. And I think that it's really interesting to kind of relate the topic of your book to a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about as it relates to, you know, design ops, creativity, the way that we move beyond this implementation and more into intention. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the designer's role as it evolves is causing some real tension, I think, in the community between people who are coming from that world of design as graphic design and moving into this world of designer as problem solver. And along the way, we're kind of grappling with some challenging stuff in terms of, like, what is design? What is actually involved in the craft? One of the things that I started noticing a lot is that designers in our community have a really unique relationship with originality and with copying. This is something that I grew up as a designer just copying rampantly. And copying was kind of the point. Like, everybody ripped off each other's work and riffed on each other's work. And it was a little bit like, Wild West because everybody had a pirated copy of Photoshop. But now
that we have,
like there's this whole copying aesthetic. But now I look on design Twitter and I see people having deep arguments about who had an idea first and who copied somebody else and how the person that copied was not as original or creative. So I would take a step back and say, like, does that really matter? If you look at it in the context of design as a whole. So I started writing little chapters on the history of copying and how copying wove itself into creativity, whether it's in the Eames furniture and how the Eames were very original in their design of furniture, but then they wanted to mass produce as much as possible and make it cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's in how John Carmack and John Romero made the early video games that they came out with, like Wolfenstein and Doom. And they were just copying off of stuff that they had seen and kind of blatantly. And John Carmack has this famous quote about how much he dislikes patents because he thinks that they're just absolutely anathema to creativity. And so I am writing these stories and bundling them together in a book in the hopes that we can have maybe a healthier relationship with copying and see it as like a totally positive thing, a force for creativity, rather than something that should be washed out or squeezed out of the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because coming from like a more developer-centric background, like copying is encouraged. And I think that that's a really different cultural aspect to it all, right? Like if you wrote code that was original code, you probably did something wrong. And so a big part of how we think about that on the developer side is very much in contrast to that idea of originality in that, you know, I would say that it is a goal of many developers to not have very much original work in the way that they've implemented software.
That's absolutely the case. That's exactly where I started with this book, which was with the question, what does open source design look like? And once you ask that question, you start to realize that all design is open source because there's no way to hide the decisions that you made. All of our work is put out there in full display and is freely available to anybody who wants to copy it. All you need to do is grab some tracing paper or like take a picture on your phone and you can recreate any design. I can take the most famous designer of all time. You know, I can take like the Johnny Ive iPhone or I can take these like really high-minded people and I can just blatantly rip them off just by tracing what they did. You know, it's not hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking about how developers encourage each other to do that. And they share their source code freely, and they create licenses that guarantee that their source code can be copied. But designers try to do the opposite, and they try to, you know, copyright their work or file design patents or protect their originality. And so I can kind of understand how development has become this super huge force in the current digital and technological explosion. And design sometimes gets kind of relegated.
That's really interesting. I also think that there's one very important part to what you were talking about, the idea of open source, right? Is open source is great in that it's freely consumable, freely usable, but also contribution is encouraged and very much respected. And I think that contribution side of it is a really essential part because that's where new knowledge comes from, right? When you think about major open source projects, the value comes in those people that are willing to give back to that community that is built up around that open source tool. And I think that is something that in the idea of open source for design, figuring out that contribution and attribution model is going to be really important to driving that as a successful way of thinking about, you know, the future of design and experience.
That's right. And the major innovation that developers maybe stumbled onto, maybe it was part of a grand scheme, was that developers not only were proactive when it came to defining attribution and licensing models, but then they also invented this great technology for enabling hundreds and thousands and millions of people to contribute to source code. And they made this thing called Git and distributed version control. And then they made that freely available to everyone. So it was this like amazing ecosystem of contribution and permissive licensing. And it formed this feedback loop that has driven a lot of the innovation and technology that we see today. So my big challenge to the people that I talk to about design is, how do we unlock that feedback loop and that growth cycle for design?
That's a really amazing topic. I would love to spend just an entire episode chatting about that. Because I feel like you said, those things that have enabled distributed revision control, have enabled contribution to happen at the scale that it needs to happen to drive innovation, that's been developer superpower. And like, I definitely don't think it was some like grand plan, right? Because the internet barely works. and you know, there's all sorts of things that are still inherently problematic about the way we think about development. But those things where we're able to democratize that contribution model across millions of people, that is what drove so much innovation in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, give me some time to finish this book and then I'll come back and we can talk about it.
Sounds great. Well, awesome. Matt, thank you so much for being on today. This was a really great conversation. Super excited to see where this book leads and love your contributions to the community. So keep it up and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
That's all for today. This has been another episode of the Design Systems Podcast. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or a topic you'd like to know more about, find us on Twitter at the DS Pod. We'd love to hear from you with show ideas, recommendations, questions, or comments. As always, this pod is brought to you by Knapsack. You can check us out at knapsack.cloud. Have a great day.